Today is Thursday, May 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. COVID-19 deaths hit a somber milestone. The man accused of funding the Rwandan genocide was back in court Wednesday fighting for his freedom.
He replied to the court, and I'm quoting here, "All of this is lies. I have not killed any Tutsi. I was working with them."
Also ahead, bad weather postpones the first launch of NASA astronauts in 9 years.
"We are not going to launch today. You are go for 5.100 launch scrub."
It's all on today's International Edition. The coronavirus pandemic has now killed more than 100,000 Americans, even as a decline in deaths has businesses reopening, Las Vegas casinos set to reopen, and citizens emerging after more than 2.5 months of lockdown. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani says President Trump is struggling to respond to a national tragedy in the same way his predecessors did.
There was George W. Bush after 9/11.
"I can hear you!"
And Barack Obama after 20 first graders were killed in their Connecticut classroom.
"I come to offer the love and prayers of a nation."
Those were sudden tragedies. The pandemic built over months, with President Trump brushing it off in February.
"One day it's like a miracle, it will disappear."
2 weeks after that,
"The question is how many people will die?"
And in mid-April,
"I think we'll be substantially, hopefully below the 100 number."
More Americans than were killed in the Vietnam and Korean Wars combined, with critics insisting far fewer would have died had he acted sooner. The president insists it's the other way.
"We would have had anywhere from 10 to 20 or 25 times the number of deaths."
Tweeting a similar message to, quote, "all the political hacks out there." Sagar Magani, Washington.
In Chile, hospital intensive care units are nearing capacity amid a flood of new coronavirus patients. And some doctors report they are having to make wrenching choices over which patients should get available beds. The nation of 18 million people has the third most coronavirus cases in the region after Brazil and Peru. Mexico also reporting more than 500 virus deaths in one day for the first time. And in India, the country surpassed 150,000 cases for another one-day high, while South Korea reported 40 new virus cases, its biggest jump in nearly 50 days. As many African countries begin to reopen, the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is urging widespread testing as the best way to avoid a surge in new cases of coronavirus. VOA's Salem Solomon spoke to the director of the Africa CDC, Dr. John Nkengasong, and has this report.
Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa CDC, told VOA to have a reasonably accurate picture of how the disease is spreading, Africa needs about 15 million tests, or enough to test about 1% of the population. To date, only 1.8 million people have been tested continent-wide.
"If we do not know a pandemic, we cannot fight a pandemic. It's like we're at war. If you do not know your enemy, you can't fight the enemy."
In order to bridge the testing gap, the Africa CDC has created the Partnership to Accelerate COVID Testing. The partnership will establish a platform for African countries to pool resources in order to buy diagnostic tools available on the international market. In Nkengasong hopes the platform will go live in about a week. To date, the Africa CDC has distributed about 2.7 million tests and has plans to distribute about 900,000 in Senegal this week. Still, Nkengasong said there are many blind spots which affect the accuracy of overall numbers.
"There are certain missing cases out there. Because our surveillance system are weak, our health system are weak, we are certainly missing cases there. The real question is by how much? Okay, but are we missing it by a whole lot, or are we missing a few cases here and there? So as we increase our testing ability, we'll be able to answer that question. The concern that we have is what we are not seeing going to harm us."
Africa has recorded a lower caseload than other parts of the globe, with about 117,000 cases of COVID-19 infection and about 3,500 deaths. However, in recent weeks, new cases have been increasing at a rate of about 30%. One headline-grabbing example took place in Ghana earlier this month when more than 500 people tested positive in one day at a fish processing factory.
Now suggests that we are on the increasing side of the slope. So we are not yet at the top of the slope, or we are not decreasing. So I think that has to be put in context. And this implies clearly that we cannot be complacent.
To combat this worrying trend, Nkengasong said the Africa CDC is leading an effort to recruit and train 1 million foot soldiers, or people who can hit the streets to do contact tracing. He also stressed the need to expand health systems to meet the additional need and to protect them from being overloaded.
The harm that if we do not protect our healthcare workers, that it may have on the overall ability to provide care for the community is huge, okay? And this includes the damage that it can cause to our HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and immunization programs. Yeah. So these are all things that we must, the challenges that we face across the board.
Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
South Africa has softened its coronavirus restrictions on houses of worship, with President Cyril Ramaphosa announcing Tuesday night that religious gatherings will now be allowed under strict conditions. Ramaphosa also announced a national day of prayer for Sunday, the day before restrictions are expected to ease across much of the country. While the nation's influential religious leaders have greeted the move with rapturous approval, not everyone agrees with it. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Go ahead and pray. It's okay. That's the word from the man at the top, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, announcing that houses of worship will now be allowed to hold in-person services with certain restrictions. The announcement softens the government's hard stance prohibiting all religious gatherings, which medical experts identified as high risk for transmission of the infectious coronavirus. Ramaphosa said that faith trumped those concerns.
As a nation, we have a responsibility to respond to this aspect of the pandemic with as much effort and urgency as we have responded to the health crisis, and as we have acted to relieve the economic and social effects on our people. We have a responsibility to also take care of the spiritual, psychological, and emotional well-being of all South Africans.
Under the new regulations, houses of worship must keep facilities clean and sanitized, limit congregations to fewer than 50 people, and require participants to wear face masks and maintain social distancing. Bishop Malusi Mpulwana, General Secretary of the influential South African Council of Churches, told VOA that the group's member churches came up with the new guidelines, giving him the assurance that they can follow them. He said heads of member churches meet weekly, online, to discuss their anti-coronavirus strategy and want to include other faiths in their discussions. The bishop stressed that for millions of lower-income South Africans who don't have the means to watch virtual services, the physical structure is a lifeline.
For several months, including times of major festivals in their churches or in their mosques and synagogues, they've been unable to get in touch with their spirituality because it's a total shutdown. It is not appropriate to say that they can only be able to do that next year when we get to level one. What it has had to mean is that we need to now look at how differently to be church in COVID time, because COVID is not going away.
Fortunately, he said, churches are familiar with the challenges posed by plagues. To that end, the council plans to widen churches' range of social services, including academic support for students who have suffered from school closures. But not everyone believes this is a good idea. Rick Robenheimer is president of the South African Secular Society, a group of atheists, skeptics, and agnostics that, since the pandemic began, has met only virtually. They do not plan to resume actual meetings, although technically, he told VOA, they could argue that they qualify under the new rules.
We think it's a bad idea from several points of view. Firstly, the president has, to date, largely followed the science, and the science says that you need to practice social distancing, not have large gatherings, take precautions against transmission, and so on. And a lot of these would be very problematic in religious gatherings, which is why the prohibition on religious gatherings, just like any other recreational gathering, has been a good idea to date. He's now making an exception for a particular community. So he's in fact going against the Constitution, which says that there shall be no discrimination on the basis of religion or belief.
A legal challenge seems unlikely, as 80% of South Africans identify as Christian. Mpawana said houses of worship now have to take the lead in showing how to live and thrive amid the coronavirus.
We are a society and we are, as churches, a community that saves lives. We should not be and cannot be that this place of worship becomes a gateway to the grave. And for that reason, we will do everything we can, and we are encouraging everyone. The reason I wear a mask is not because I fear you will contaminate me. I wear a mask because I fear I might contaminate you, and I do not know if I'm a carrier or not. It is an act of love that I will not shake your hand. It is an act of love that I'll be distant from you. It is an act of love to make sure that all of us survive beyond this.
Ramaphosa has declared Sunday, May 31st, a national day of prayer across the Rainbow Nation. More than 520 South Africans have died of the virus since March. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Southern Hemisphere's first human trials of a potential coronavirus vaccine have started in Australia. 131 people between the ages of 18 and 59 are involved in the program in Melbourne and Brisbane. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
The potential vaccine NVX-CoV-2373 is being developed by the American biotech company Novavax. It started working on the drug in January when the COVID-19 outbreak began in China. It aims to boost the body's immune response and stimulate high levels of neutralizing antibodies. If the vaccine works, researchers hope 100 million doses can be made by the end of this year and 1.5 billion next year. Researchers say that vaccines are miracles and have a great way of protecting populations against these severe diseases. Dr. Paul Griffin is an infectious diseases expert who's involved in the Australian COVID-19 trial. He hopes the drug will successfully attack the virus and be ready for use within months.
We look for antibodies and the type and number of antibodies, and then we take some things out of the subjects through those blood tests and do a lot of laboratory experiments to show that it neutralises the virus. The company manufacturing the vaccine have already started that scaling up process, so they're already making a lot of doses of this vaccine. So if we can prove it's safe and effective, then potentially by the end of the year there'll be a significant number of doses available.
Australian authorities say the trial is a significant step forward in the global race for a coronavirus vaccine. Some participants will receive a placebo, while others will be administered Novavax's drug. Early results are expected in July, and scientists expect some conclusive results by the end of this year. Phase 2 trials would take place with thousands of volunteers in several countries. Volunteers are still needed, and the research team has stressed that no live coronavirus is used in experiments on people. Novavax has received $388 million from the Norway-based Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. There are more than 100 potential coronavirus vaccines in development, and about a dozen have made it to the human trial stage. It is a global race potentially worth billions of dollars to those who can find a safe and reliable treatment for a virus that has killed almost 350,000 people around the world. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
15 to 24-year-olds around the world are suffering huge unemployment since the coronavirus hit their jobs earlier this year. Data from the International Labor Organization shows young people have lost jobs at a faster and greater rate than any other segment of society. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The International Labor Organization says 13.6%, or around 267 million young people worldwide, were not employed or engaged in education or training at the end of last year. Those pre-pandemic figures are higher than before the 2008 global financial crisis. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says the situation since then has become considerably worse.
perhaps the most important conclusion in our monitor is that of young people who were working prior to the pandemic, well, more than one in six of those young people is now no longer working. They have been basically ejected from their jobs. Those who are still working have suffered a major reduction in their working time of some 23%.
The ILO monitor finds young women are more seriously affected by the rapid increase in youth unemployment than young men. It says the pandemic also is disrupting education and skills training, which will hurt their chances of finding work and consign most to future low-paying dead-end jobs. Ryder says the so-called lockdown generation will face the danger of permanent exclusion from the labor market. He warns young people will be left behind in big numbers as the world emerges from the pandemic.
Is that this initial shock to young people will last a decade or longer than a decade. It will affect the trajectory of working people, young working people, throughout their working lives. So it will be people who will be permanently scarred by the immediate effects of the pandemic.
Ryder says available evidence shows more than half of the world's young people are vulnerable to anxiety and depression. He says the pandemic and loss of job opportunities will likely increase the number afflicted by mental health conditions. The ILO is calling for urgent, large-scale, and targeted policies to support youth. It says governments must invest in the future of young people by offering education and training programs. ILO Chief Ryder warns sidelining young people with a lack of opportunity or skills will make it much more difficult to rebuild a better post-COVID-19 economy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Amnesty International says the Nigerian military is unlawfully detaining boys and men at a rehabilitation center for alleged members of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The allegations of rights abuses were detailed in a report Wednesday, which criticized the program known as Operation Safe Corridor. The program receives financial aid and technical support from the European Union, the United States, Britain, and the UN International Organization for Migration. As EU nations begin to think about lifting travel restrictions imposed at the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the European Union's Public Health Agency says border closures do little to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The European Center for Disease Prevention and Control said measures such as testing travelers before departure or temperature screening on arrival are also largely ineffective, though it confirmed that traveling does facilitate the spread of the virus. And the French government is canceling a decree allowing hospital workers to administer hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for patients suffering severe forms of COVID-19. France is the first country to take action since the World Health Organization said on Monday it will pause a large trial of the malaria drug on COVID-19 patients due to safety concerns. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. Cameroonians are fleeing the northwestern village of Ngarba after the military began building a base this week near where troops in February massacred at least 13 civilians. Cameroon says the base is needed to stop separatists from getting supplies in neighboring Nigeria. But as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde, villagers fear they may once again be targeted or get caught in the crossfire.
22-year-old Cameroonian farmer Emelda Tata says she and her family were among around 100 villagers who fled Ngarbu on Sunday morning after several military trucks full of troops arrived. The troops began constructing buildings for a military base to fight off Anglophone rebels in the area. Speaking via a messaging application from the neighboring village of Ngonzen, Tata said the military's massacre in their village was still fresh in their minds.
On the 14th of February, military people entered Garbu and killed many women and innocent children. The military has built a camp in the village again, and the villagers think that this same military that was supposed to protect them, they are the very people killing them, so they have to flee to neighboring villages where they feel they'll be more secured.
Cameroonian rights groups and opposition political parties have criticized the base in Garbu, saying it will only increase tensions with villagers. They estimate over 300 villagers have fled Garbu within the past week. National President of the United Socialist Democratic Party, Prince Ekoso, says the military presence in the village is uncalled for.
Why establish a military base in Garbu where the military has been accused of massacring civilians, children, women, pregnant women? We are calling on the government to retrieve the initiative of establishing a military base in Garbu, and we call on the international community to put their eyes on this particular situation in Garbu. The use of force has never resolved any conflict.
Despite the ongoing tensions between the villagers and military, Cameroon authorities say the new military base is needed to stop rebels from resupplying in neighboring Nigeria. Speaking Sunday on state radio, Cameroon government spokesman René Emmanuel Sadi defended the base as a needed defense against the rebels. Although troops had killed civilians, said Sadi, most atrocities in the area were committed by the separatists.
La plupart de ces terroristes dans la localité de Garbu se déguise en policier.
He said most of the rebel fighters in Garbu disguised themselves as Cameroon troops to commit atrocities on villagers just to give troops a bad image and make civilians hate their military. Sadi said the troops are out to protect civilians from the rebels who are stealing, raping, abducting for ransom, and making life very difficult in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. He says the troops will protect Cameroon's border with Nigeria and stop the separatists from using the border for supplies. Human Rights Watch said in April the attack in Garbu was part of a larger pattern of rights violations by Cameroon's military in the Anglophone regions. Cameroon's President Paul Biya admitted in April troops committed the massacre after an international outcry when authorities initially denied it. Biya ordered the arrest of troops that attempted to cover up the deaths by burning homes and filing a false report. Some 600 villagers in Garbu had fled immediately following the atrocity. The separatists have been fighting since 2017 to carve out an English-speaking state from French-speaking majority Cameroon. The United Nations says the fighting has cost more than 3,000 lives and forced 500,000 to flee to French-speaking regions or into neighboring Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Hong Kong police fired pepper pellets to disperse protesters in the heart of the Global Financial Center Wednesday and arrested about 240 people as national security legislation proposed by Beijing revived anti-government demonstrations. Journalist Ria Mogul, reporting from the Asian Financial Hub, provided International Edition's Steve Miller with an update via WhatsApp.
About 300 people have been arrested today for taking part in an illegal assembly. Now, the protests were called, of course, because of the national security laws, but also because there was a contentious national anthem bill that was being debated at the Legislative Council today. So there were quite a few people that gathered, and a heavy police presence and multiple rounds of pepper spray were fired in retaliation as protesters attempted to gather in multiple districts in Hong Kong.
What is the legislation moving forward, the likelihood that it's going to pass?
So today was the second hearing of the national anthem bill. And of course, activists had asked for people to block LegCo to delay the reading of the bill. This is a tactic that was actually used last year when there was the reading of the ill-fated extradition bill. And because so many people had gathered around the building, lawmakers were unable to enter the building. And the bill, as we all know, was subsequently shelved. Today's tactics were a little bit different, however, and it's not unusual to see a change in tactics from protesters, because of course this is a very decentralized protest movement. It's not like the 2014 Umbrella Revolution, where we had a clear leader, Joshua Wong. This is big groups of people that manage things on social media and use Telegram to send each other messages. So these protests were supposed to kick off in the morning, and they never quite transpired in the way that they were about to, that they were meant to. Instead, there was just a heavy police presence outside the building, of course, learning from example last year. And police were conducting, you know, stop searches with journalists mainly, as well as other people that were passing by. And the bill did go to debate, and they were debating this bill inside the Legislative Council today. We don't have a hearing on when it's likely to be passed, but it probably will be passed in the coming weeks.
So where do things go from here?
Last year, we had the historic 1 million, 2 million strong marches. And it's important to note that those were actually marches that were authorized and they were approved by the police. They had a letter of no objection. Carrie Lam, earlier this week, said at a press conference that the new law would not erode the freedom in Hong Kong. But a lot of people don't believe her. A lot of people think that this is not true. And, you know, there's complete mistrust in the government. They don't follow what she says at all. And so the protests are likely to continue and will probably continue for a while, because we've got some key dates coming up as well. You know, June 4th is the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. July 1st is the annual pro-democracy march that takes place every year. So we've just got to wait and see.
Journalist Ria Mogul in Hong Kong speaking with International Edition Steve Miller.
Brothers have decided to postpone their 50th anniversary tour until next July because of the coronavirus pandemic. The tour was supposed to begin in June, with Michael McDonald planning to rejoin the band for the tour. The Doobie Brothers are due to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Laurie London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care of yourselves and be well.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Wunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.